All right. This is the New Glarus Brewing Podcast with Dan Carey. I am Scott May, and I'm sitting across from Dan Carey this afternoon. How are you doing, Dan?
Good. How about you, Scott?
I'm doing okay. I find myself in sort of the brain fog of like winter weather, everyone getting a cold, shut down schools at the tail end of Christmas kind of a time.
Yeah, well, and it's kind of foggy outside and warm too. It's above freezing, so it's kind of weird.
Yeah, it's like I always tell people, like I love being in the upper Midwest. I always, I'm from here. I can deal with the winters and everything, but no one on the face of the earth can sell me on the idea that the end of January to like the beginning of March is a fun time for anybody.
No, it's not. Slush weather.
But that's why, you know, for me personally, why I think having sort of the seasonal attachment stuff to beer is always sort of important for me. So when the darker beers and stuff start coming out, like you sort of can attach yourself onto things that make you feel better about the gray cragginess in which Wisconsin becomes.
Yeah, I agree.
So we're going to be sort of talking about a beer that's returning a little bit today, and also talking a little bit about sort of what your job as a brewer is and what your job is as a master brewer as you move through your career and sort of find yourself where you are. Does that sound about right?
Sure. We'll give it a shot.
We will give it a shot. This beer came out 2 years ago.
Chocolate stout. I think it's been since, yeah, probably.
And I remember when this beer came out, cause I'm always very excited when you come out with your stouts and the sort of rotating selection of road slush or coffee stout always makes me really happy. And then when I saw sort of a new one on the docket, I was very excited to try it. And I really remember enjoying this beer. But then it, you know, as is wont to do, some beers just don't come around again for a little bit. And I noticed on this one, it's now milk chocolate stout or chocolate milk stout. And I knew it had lactose in it before. Was there a reason why you wanted to emphasize sort of that component of it in this iteration?
Well, we've worked with chocolate for a long time, for well over a decade. And it was chocolate was a hard thing for me to wrap my head around how to brew with it because, chocolate is a relatively complicated flavor. There's lots of different types of chocolate flavor, and how to get a given flavor in a beer is not so easy. Originally, you know, we tried, adding like chocolate to the brew kettle, and that didn't really work. And we tried lots of different permeations, and what we were always trying to get was a milk chocolate type of a character. So, being growing up as an American kid, we grew up on Hershey's chocolate, and you know that's kind of has a kind of a mixed feeling among people. But as far as I'm concerned, Hershey's is great chocolate, so to try to mimic that creamy, milky chocolate flavor was what we were moving towards. And we've made three or four different types of chocolate beers over the years.
There's like a chocolate Abbey and...
Yeah, exactly. Chocolate blueberry.
Yes, and which was very, very good.
Yeah, so those were all really fun. And there is a style of beer called... A cream stout, which is made with the addition of lactose, which is milk sugar. And the milk sugar gives sort of a creamy background flavor to the beer. And so we had this milk stout, and it was very successful. It's very creamy and rich and sweet, creamy. And in the lab, Sam Bennett said, you know, we should try this adding chocolate to this beer and see what it does. And it just really sang of that sort of milk chocolate flavor. And so it was an idea that just she kind of came up with off the cuff, and it really, really worked. And out of that came a chocolate version of our milk stout. It's a natural progression.
That's really cool. And this is in cans, in thumbprint cans. So I'm going to open this up right here. And
I love these cans. It's really cool.
Every single time I look at one of these cans, I get happy. I love the way these came together. And the fact that these beers, like Milk Chocolate Stout, are now going into these cans. And like, I think I saw Dancing Man is going to be in cans. Not these cans, but other cans.
Yeah, yep.
And Scream in cans. It's opened up a thing for me that I just really enjoy, because there's something satisfying about cracking the can and then also, you know, crunching it up and throwing it in the recycling afterwards.
Yeah, exactly. They are definitely eminently recyclable, which is nice. Plus these black and red can, they look nice, and the kind of textured label on the can has a nice feel to it, a textured feel.
It really does. And smelling this, this is smelling exactly as I remembered it. And exactly as you're describing it, it is that milk chocolate nose. As soon as you smell it, you're like, I'm going to get something sort of sweet, but you can almost smell the bitter back end to it.
Well, to me, I also smell like, there are no almonds in this beer, mm-hmm. but it almost smells like when you open a Hershey's chocolate with almonds, which is always my favorite candy bar. So I find it very inviting, and it's got really nice foam.
Oh, 100%. And I'm getting the almonds. Now that you're mentioning that, I can totally see where you're coming from with it, because it does have that sort of roasty, nutty sort of quality on the back end that like really good chocolate does. And I guess, you know, my first question, and this is just like, you know, Scott's dumb question corner on a beer like this, but when you have, you know, a chocolate stout and it has lactose in it, and it's milk chocolate stout, and you've sort of explained you wanted to invoke milk chocolate, it also invokes to me like chocolate milk, which I guess can kind of be the same thing.
Yes.
And when I'm tasting this, I'm getting a really like a smoothness to it that I would associate with, you know, with, like you were saying before, like the creaminess of a lactose or sort of a beverage, you know, with that in it.
Well, there's plenty of hops in there too, so it's not satiatingly sweet.
It is not.
It's dry in the end, like a little bit of a dark chocolate almost, just a mini amount to balance the sweet milk chocolate character.
Well, that's what I was going to say. You're definitely getting milk chocolate off of this, which is exactly what you want, especially when you see on the can milk chocolate stout. But because of the hopping on the back end, It's invoking a very fancy dark chocolate as well.
Yeah, that's true.
It's sort of pulled like a neat little trick with it, right?
Yeah, it's kind of a foot in both worlds.
A little bit. So I know, you know, we've been doing episodes talking about beers and episodes talking about brewing. You know, I think it'd be kind of fun just to have a beer and talk a little bit about brewing, because we don't really marry those two a whole lot. Sure. But I have found myself wondering about, you know, the daily life of a master brewer, right? Because I get to sit down and have these conversations with you, and they're very illuminating to me. But still, you know, if I ask myself, well, what do I think Dan does at 9 a.m.? It's like, I literally have no idea. So if you would indulge me a little bit, what do you do at 9 a.m.? Like, what do you do when you walk through the door?
What do I do all day?
I don't want it to come across like, what does that guy do all day? But you know what I mean? You're obviously very busy doing a lot of things, none of which I think I have a firm conceptual grasp on.
Well, I graduated from brewing school for over 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And, I've been working in a breweries since that time in a lead position. I guess, you know, you'd call it a brewmaster, and a brewmaster can mean lots of things depending on where you're at in your career. And probably more importantly, how large your brewery is. If it's a, you know, when we started, the New Glarus Brewing Company 31 years ago, I was the only person, so I was chief cook and bottle washer. I did everything, and you know, I had one, ended up getting one helper and then a couple. And so in the early days, I was the one that was brewing. And as the business has grown, I've basically had to give away spheres of responsibility. And what I mainly do now is, you know, it's like a 10,000 foot view. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like like in war when a general's up on a hill with binoculars watching the battle, or flying in a helicopter over the battle, kind of directing things. And so I'm more of a director than anything. So the days of it used. So I went from in the early days that I was the one making the beer. I'd brew every single batch of beer, and then I run the bottling line one day, and I'd brew one day, and I'd filter one day. And so then as the business grew, more and more people came on board, and then I only started to brew when somebody was on vacation. So I would be vacation relief. And now my job is mainly overseeing and managing. And the business has changed. We have really talented young people. In a lot of ways, they're smarter than I am. And so a lot of what is done on a daily basis is delegated to them. So we have systems, procedures, what we call SOPs or standard operating procedures, or ways of doing things, or culture that I have developed and other people have added to over the years that they follow. And it's my job to basically simply make sure that we stay on track, or that we pick a direction. The thing about business is, you know, I mean, there's myriad directions you could go. So, I help to direct the direction, and I'm less autocratic and more collaborative, because we have so many good brewers and so many good scientists that are maybe involved on the floor more than I am, have great ideas, alternative thinking, things that I never thought of. And so we work in a team environment. So what my day consists of is when I come into the brewery, I might take a walk around the brewery. When I come in from the parking lot, I come in the back door. So I start at the packaging lines, and I might, you know, we collect carbon dioxide gas and reuse it. Yeah. So I might look and see how much oxygen is in that. What's the dissolved oxygen level in our CO2? How are we doing? I'll walk out to the bottling line, talk to the operator, say good morning, see again what kind of dissolved oxygen levels and total package oxygen we have on our packages. How's it looking? Talk to the operators about how they're doing. Then I might walk through the cellar, take a look at how centrifugation of today's batch is going. I'll talk to the operators, get a sense, look around. Maybe I'll see something that's in need of repair. Mm-hmm. And I'll make a note to pass it on to maintenance to fix something, or something needs to be painted. That's why our brewery is so clean, because constantly looking, and other people now are. I get a pulse, I take the pulse of the brewery in the morning. Yeah. And then I walk past the brew house, see how they're doing, look in the vessels, see how the beer looks, the wort looks, maybe through the lab to say good morning. So in that 30-minute time, I kind of have a sense of how things are going.
Yeah, the whole operation.
Yeah, and most people know at this point that if they're having a problem that they're dealing with, mm-hmm. they may or may not say anything to me, because if it's under control, there's always something.
Something's everywhere. Always on fire. Yeah.
But sometimes they will say, I just think you should know, you know, such and such happened last night, and this is what we're doing about it. Or they may say, I don't know what to do. Can we meet with you today? And then we'll arrange a meeting. And so a lot of what I do are meetings impromptu as things come up. So, we have what we would call firefighting when we're dealing with what I call the problem du jour, whatever is happening.
Assuming there's only the one.
Well, yeah, there usually is more than, I mean, in a large brewery, there's always lots of things that are going on. You know, when I worked for a very, very large brewer in my previous life. And I also worked for very, very small brewers. And people in small breweries say, well, what's it like in a big brewery? Well, the difference between working in a really large brewery and a small brewery is you have the same amount of problems, but in a multi-million barrel brewery, you just have many, many more of them at once. And you're going 24/7. So lots of problems are happening. It's the same.
Yeah.
Manufacturing. That's why people don't like to manufacture, because manufacturing is problematic.
It's hard. It's hard, especially when the more mechanized, I guess, it becomes, the less, you know, physical toll it can take on a person, but the more mechanical issue you might have to face. So it always seems like there's going to be a trade-off, right?
That's true. Then I'll go into my office and I'll look at the emails. I get lots and lots of, unfortunately, I hate emails. But it's how the modern business world communicates. So we'll have emails from suppliers. And so I'll read emails. And then at 11 o'clock we have our morning tasting every mm-hmm. day. So more or less every day, 5 days a week, I'll go to taste panel, which usually lasts an hour. And we taste the beer that is the beer that's going to be packaged mm-hmm. in the next few days. So we taste beer before it's packaged to make sure that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
To make sure that we're blending it the way that we want to blend it, that everything is okay. And then we also have what are called release tasting. So a lot of our beers are bottle fermented. They're fermented in the bottle. So it goes through a secondary fermentation in the package. So the beer is held for some days or some weeks. And so we taste that to make sure that it's ready to ship out. We maybe have test brews or pilot brews that we taste. And we also taste what we call competitor beers. So we might taste other people's beers versus our beer, like maybe our IPA versus three or four other beers from the marketplace that people bring us or that we buy, just to kind of gauge where we're at. And then we spend time discussing strategy about how we're doing, how's we're using this mash temperature and it had this effect on beer foam. The attenuation went down. Should we tweak this? Should we tweak that? Should we up the bitterness? Should we lower the bitterness? You know, the color's too dark, the color's too light. We're not talking about huge changes, but subtle steering of the ship. So that 11 o'clock panel is very, very important.
Yeah, it seems like it, because that seems like a sort of a heartbeat of the operation of like, you know, we've done all the planning. We've overseen it. The SOPs are there. Now there's beer in a glass. What does it taste like today?
Yeah, that's all that matters. And then that brings me up to more lunch. And, you know, I might take 15 minutes and eat my lunch. And then we have more meetings, maybe meetings about capital projects that we're taking on. Or we also have brand meetings. Sam Bennett, will put together reports on a campaign. Maybe we finish running Dancing Man for mm-hmm. the year, and she'll write a fairly in-depth report, multiple page report, 10 page report, listing all the chemical parameters and tasting notes and observations from everybody about the beer. And we'll talk about kind of a postmortem on how the campaign went. We'll taste the beer, various ages of the beer, and decide how we want to move forward, say next year, when we brew that beer. So those brand meetings are important. We also have meetings about beers that we're getting ready to brew. Mm-hmm. We're getting ready to make our Pilsner, for example. So next week we'll have a fairly in-depth meeting with all of the key players. We'll sit down and talk about the recipe and the recipe is a piece of paper that lists, how many pounds of malt, what temperature, what yeast, what cell count, and all of those kind of parameters for brewing. But the brewing of the beer is much more in depth than that. So we'll talk about exactly how we're going to run the campaign. And
because it seems like you've come around to this point a few different times that you can write whatever you want on a recipe. You still have to, a recipe isn't a beer. It still has to, it still has to go through this alchemy and this magic sort of thing.
That's right. You know, it's like, I know it's sort of sometimes brewers, when they're marketing, they like to say that they found a recipe in grandpa's chest in the attic, and that's the beer that they're coming out with. That's just marketing, because that's not really.
Well, and who was Grandpa?
Well,
was he a great brewer, or was he a guy?
Well, it's not so much that, but I mean, a recipe is 1,000 pounds of Pils malt, 100 pounds of Munich malt, so many pounds of Hallertau hops. That's not really. I mean, that's like saying, I want 4 violins and 2 drums and a bass, and that's not music. That's not what a recipe is. It's the idiosyncrasies of how something is made. So that's complete fantasy. The raw materials are completely different.
Yeah, because it seems like with brewers, the recipe is important, but the knowledge seems to live in your guys, in your guys' muscles and your bones and your synapses.
Well, right. And your machinery.
It's
in your machinery. How your machinery is designed, how you use your machinery has a huge impact. I think all brewers know that if you write down a recipe for, say, pale ale, and you give it to 10 brewers, and it's the exact same recipe, all of those beers will taste very, very different between breweries. It's not an exact science, but so a lot of effort is put into discussing what we brewed and what we need to learn from that and what we're going to brew next. And then we also have a lot of research and development. So, we meet and talk about, our research and development projects. How are we doing? Or we're looking at new raw materials. We're looking at new yeast. We're looking at new processes. So we make test brews and we discuss those sorts of things. So I'm, steering the ship from more or less from above. We, are always talking about new beers and new ideas and new flavors. So we might meet and discuss that. And then I've talked mainly about machinery and process, but then there are the human side of brewing. Mm-hmm. And as Debs always says, people make beer, not machines. So a lot of what happens in the brewery has to do with the personalities of the people that are brewing it, having the right person in the right place, and dealing with people's temperaments. People do ebb and flow in their, over the years, and their personality and their passion and things that happen in their lives. So Scott Knoll is really the person who his job is to pay attention to if people are getting what they need to do the job, that they are feeling like they're being heard, that they have the tools they need. And so he'll communicate with me about what he's finding in the brewery, what departments are having personnel issues or discrepancies that need to be worked out.
Oh yeah, he's super good at that job. He stopped me in the hallway and says, "Scott, you're looking a little, you feeling okay? You're looking a little." I was like, middle of winter kind of blues. So he noticed as I put his hand on my shoulder. He's like, "You're doing good."
Yeah.
Have a good one.
Him and Deb are savants when it comes to reading people and knowing what people are really saying. I find that being from California, that I find that people in Wisconsin, I say, you guys talk between the lines. Saying to somebody, "Have a nice day," that can mean lots of things. That can be giving somebody the finger to,
I'm really having a nice day.
Exactly. So
If someone from the Midwest, if you ask someone from the Midwest how they're doing and they say, get that person help.
That's right. That's right.
Is struggling.
Yeah, that's right. I'm doing okay. That's not good.
That is not good.
And so that sort of understanding of human nature and human language is something that Deb and Scott are really, really good at. So I'm really blessed that, and I also have people who are savants when it comes to machinery.
Yeah.
So I have a lot of experience with machinery. I know every valve and pump and floor drain and low spot in the brewery, but as years have gone by, a lot of that has been given to other people. So I only get drafted into the game when things are really, really in need of my help. I mainly look to the future. Mm-hmm. What do we need to do to keep moving forward? And also, as I've said many times, raw material procurement, although hops are more and more going to Randy Teal, and malt is going more and more to Tammy Hansen. So I'm less and less involved in the day-to-day and more involved in the direction, the overview of what we're going to do.
Yeah.
We're going to use this supplier, but you're going to carry out the action of working with them to make sure we get what we want.
The system as a whole.
Yeah.
So in hearing that, that does illuminate a lot of things for me. The first question it answers in my head was, I always was like, why the heck does Dan park all the way around back? His office is in the front.
That's 100% right. It forces me to walk through the brewery.
Yeah. And then I started thinking, you know, as you were answering, I was like, this makes so much sense. You know, you park in the back, you come through the maintenance shop. If those guys got something going on in the maintenance shop, well, that's the first thing you can check
that's
on.
That's right.
And then
I can see what's busted on a table in the maintenance shop when I walk in the morning.
Exactly. And then I was like thinking about how the brewery's laid out. And I was like, well, this is so smart too, because it's laid out for visitors can take a very easy horseshoe tour from beginning to end of process. But you can also do that tour too on a daily basis from the end to the beginning or the beginning to the end.
And I walk through and talk to visitors.
Yeah.
And which they think is fun. And it also helps me to understand what people are thinking. Deb set the brewery up in a very specific way, which at first was kind of annoying to the people in the warehouse, because the warehouse is a long way from the time clock.
Well, as you guys add warehouses back in, they get further away.
Yeah, like you almost need a bicycle to go from the far end of the warehouse to the time clock in the lunchroom. But my office and my door is always open 99% of the time, is right near the time clock. And they have to walk past my office to get to the lunchroom. So 80% of people have to walk past my office. And, I say good morning or good afternoon. And it allows me to also hear people talking around the time clock.
Mm-hmm.
Although I'm deaf, I can still hear what people are talking. And when people are going to the lunchroom, I get a sense for what's going on. So it allows me to stay involved in the day-to-day operation of what's happening in the business. And you can learn a lot by just watching and listening and smelling and hearing.
Oh yeah. It's funny, when I used to work kitchens, you know, going in for the night closing shift and you open the door, the back door of the kitchen, you get a whiff of it and you're like, oh, something went wrong today. You smell a burn in the air or something. It's just
that's right.
This place just doesn't feel right today.
Or you can see everybody's looking down at their shoes.
Yeah.
Something's gone down here.
And the other question sort of brought up in my mind is, as you were, you know, describing it as sort of looking from 10,000 feet up, or, you know, sort of being on the hill and looking down at the action sort of playing out in front of you and watching your system operate, is there ever a time when you sort of want to reach down, but you're like, okay, this is not the time for me to insert myself here?
Yeah, definitely. That's a really, really good question. It's been a progress for me. It used to be, I did everything myself. That was many, many years ago. And then we got to the point where I was working in a group with side by side with brewers. And then, like I said, I would be covering people's vacations. And then I, you know, went more and more to the office. So I am... I'm somewhat compulsive, and I like to do things a certain way. I want them done a certain way. And I used to be of the opinion that if you want it done right, you have to do it yourself. And that serves well for the first 3 years of a business when you don't have anybody and it has to get done and no one's trained. But eventually, once you get large enough to pass that up, that becomes insulting, because most people, if they're in the right job, that's a big if, but if you put people in the right place, they will succeed. Given the choice, people prefer to do a good job versus not a good job. Most people.
Yeah.
So I had to learn to get out of people's way. And that was, that was a hard thing for me to learn, because I'm inherently fearful, and I'm passionate. My name is on the can and the bottles. I want it done right. And to be able to trust people was difficult for me. And Scott Knoll was, he helped me, he coached me. He's really good at these sorts of things to teach people how to talk to me, which was huge. That was probably the biggest thing. When people understood where I was coming from and what I needed to hear, that was probably the first step towards me moving to a level of trust.
Yeah, of comfort.
Yeah, and so I rarely jump in. If there is a problem and I sense that the team, the quality circle that's working on that, whatever that problem is, for example, we're putting in a new cellar automation package, a really big multi-million dollar project to,
I saw the fiber optics guys were up the hill today.
Yeah. It's a major project to allow our brewers to do more with less, to make them much, much more powerful. And so there was a problem with the design. They're testing right now, and they weren't, through a pipe, you need a certain liquid flow to clean a pipe. Okay. And they were unable to achieve that. And the pressure in the line was getting too high, thus being dangerous. So they made a test where they put in a third pump on the cleaning loop to increase the flow and lower the pressure. And in the old days, I would have had to go out and diagnose a problem and fix it myself. But at this point, they just came to me and said, we had this problem and this is our resolution. We had a pump in the warehouse, so we're bringing it out and we're going to plumb it in place and program it and move on. So the majority of the time, they're trained. They know the procedures. They know what I expect. And it gets done, and it gets done better than I would have done it. So the only time I get involved is when I really feel like things are not getting resolved or the team can't figure it out. And team leaders that have been, or brewers that have been around me long enough, know me well enough that if they are feeling frustrated and stymied or uncertain where to go, and then they'll come to me, and then I will jump into the game. So that happens once a week, twice a month, maybe, where there's a problem that's big enough that they don't know the solution, and I'll study on it, and then I'll set up a quality circle meeting with brewers and team leaders and engineers and lab techs, all of the people that are stakeholders in the decision, and I'll help direct. I won't dictatorially say, this is where you're going to go. I may, if I feel strongly about something, but mostly I try to work in a collaborative way, that this is the problem. What do you guys, first of all, you have to understand what the cause of the problem is before you can solve it. And I'm a big fan of a book called The Toyota Way, by a guy by the name of Liker, and L-I-K-K-E-R. So Liker wrote this book called The Toyota Way, and it's all of the philosophy of the Toyota company, which is a manufacturing business.
Yeah.
And in the book, they talk about the five whys. So if you have a problem, something is not right, a process is not working, why is it not working? Then there's an answer. Well, why is that not? Why is that a problem? And then you do that five times and you get down to really what the problem is. The kingdom was lost for lack of a horseshoe. So you don't want to deal with fixing the kingdom. You want to make sure that the horses have shoes on them, and that will solve your problem. And so I'm very well schooled in these methods of philosophical ways of managing, so I can kind of push in this direction so that we don't go off, as they say, half-cocked.
Yeah, and I like that a lot, because it sparks in my mind the idea of, like, you know, you got a problem way down the end at the end of the river, and you're trying to stop a whole river, and it's like, well, no, you gotta walk up the river.
That's right.
What's going on at the mouth up there, you know?
That's right.
That's making this problem so huge down here. But one comment in listening to you talk and answering that question is, I just think it's really cool that it seems like you did a lot of reflecting time at some point.
Oh, yeah.
And decided, okay, I can go one of two ways with this thing. I can either clamp down even tighter or I can open up. And it seems like you made the healthier of the two choices, which not a lot of, I think not a lot of people in your position are want to make, you know what I mean?
Yeah, change is hard.
Yeah.
As the brewery grew, we had to reinvent ourselves. Like most craft breweries in the late 90s and early 2000s, the business was growing by 10 to 50% a year. And when that happens, the way of doing business changes. So a way of thinking about it is that if you have a house, you have 1800 square foot house and you have a spouse and a child, and then you get another child, and eventually you have 12 or 15 children. It doesn't happen anymore, but it used to.
It sometimes would. I think my dad was one of nine.
Yeah. In the old days, especially among Irish Catholics, way it was.
Us Catholics, yeah. Well, you needed somebody to work the farm stuff, you know?
But my point is the analogy of you outgrow your system and you have to keep reinventing how you do things.
Yeah.
And that is very, very stressful, causes great anxiety. And sometimes people will bow out, and that's when breweries are sold, when you realize that I no longer have the temperament nor the skill set to manage a very, very large brewery. Yeah. So I'm going to abdicate and give it this to somebody else to run the system. So in order for me to survive, I had to adapt, because the autocratic do it yourself, get out of my way leadership of the first 3 years of the brewery served me very, very well. But after 5 years or 6 years, it's becomes offensive to the people around you. So I either need to change, or they will leave. And yeah. If you have somebody who's trained well and doing a great job, it's my responsibility to make sure that that person has everything they need to be successful on our team. So I've had to reinvent myself many, many times over the years. Of course, when you're in your 30s, you're, full of a lot more piss and vinegar than you are in the 60s. You kind of have a tendency to get more mellow.
Does this matter to me right now?
I mean, I can tell you that, I've said to your wife, my daughter, that look, 30s, you just turned 40 and
41.
So, yeah.
Well, I'm getting deeper in there now.
On the slippery slope.
Yeah.
It gets easier as you get older, because when you're in your 30s, life is like musical chairs and it's uncertain and it's a lot of sharp elbows and trying to make sure that you're not the one that's left standing when the music stops. And as you get older, you find your place. So I think that mellowing is part of getting older. And it's also, I had to do it in order to, for the sake of the brewery, the sake of the business, to make sure that we can succeed.
Yeah. And it's funny that you mention it, because like even now I'll find myself like ramping up for like a fight, like a rhetorical, I'm gonna have an argument now. And then I'll find myself like 30 seconds into it going, why am I doing this?
Yeah.
Dude, I actually don't care about what we're arguing about right now.
Yeah. Well, that's the wisdom of age.
I'm not that wise yet, because I still start the fight, but I just bow out a lot earlier these days.
Yeah. As long as you don't start it and walk away, that's those kind of people suck.
Yeah. That's kind of the worst. But so, we're talking about, sort of becoming the field, working yourself into becoming the field, general. And
yeah.
And I think a lot of, a lot of folks who may be listening and, have sort of aspirations or are running their own brewery kind of look to you and go like, when does it stop? When do you win? You know what I mean? Do you get to a point in your career, and you're certainly at a point in yours where, I don't think anyone on the face of the planet could argue you're not just a wildly successful brewer, but does it ever come to the point where you just sort of go, I've won, the systems are in place, and now I get to be as content and happy as any brewer wrangling beer can be?
Short answer is no.
No, I kind of figured.
There are options. You either retire, mm-hmm. sell out, or move on.
Yeah.
You know, go fishing, or you, you do that. You, you abdicate and, sit in your office, and then the business will atrophy.
Yeah.
And slowly die. Or the other last one is to keep, keep learning. You know, I find that, as I get older, the need for, exercise and good sleep and moderation becomes important, because you know, your body can't handle the abuses that it did when you were, you know, 18 or 20. So one has to exercise and eat well. So you have to be deliberate and diligent. So to stay running a brewery into 60s and then late 60s, you have to continue to develop. And everybody, even if you're 18 or 70, you have to continue to learn, continue to develop if you want to continue to be better, because remaining where you're at now good enough is not really going to be good enough, because things get more and more competitive. There's a lot of really smart young brewers out there making absolutely beautiful beers. So to keep up with the young punks, I need to, you know, keep reinventing myself and learning from them, and being introspective and trying always to do better.
That's a ridiculously awesome answer. And I absolutely love it, because, you know, it does illustrate something I've always just sort of liked and admired about you, is you don't seem like a person who just goes, I know who I am and I just move forward with you seem like a person who's always inquisitive and trying to figure out yourself and your business and the things you like to do and what keeps you moving and motivated. You don't strike me as a person who just says, you know, as you put it before, just thought, you know, the autocratic thing of just like, well, I know who I am, I know what I'm doing, and I am right, so that's what we're doing. And I really enjoy that about you.
Oh, well, thanks. Deb has a saying in the brewery that she's used probably since day one to, you know, because a lot of times people in the brewery, marketing people, salespeople, will look at what other brewers are doing and we got to do this. We got to do 19.2 ounce cans or whatever. The wholesalers are always, you know, this is hot, whatever's hot for that, you know, because there's always something hot that month.
Yes.
And I think anybody who's listened to these podcasts will see that we are somewhat contrary. And Deb had the saying, which is to be number one, you must actively work to surpass yourself, not the competition.
Yeah. It's irrelevant what's hot right now. If making, you know, a hard seltzer in a 40 ounce bottle isn't going to be your thing.
Well, you know, that's funny, because I was listening to to a webinar with a brewer from Colorado, Peter Buchart, and he was talking about those sorts of things. That's not what you should be looking at. You should be looking at what the undercurrents are, what's coming next, because what's hot now, it's already been done, and you don't want to be an also ran. You want to try to understand what's coming down the pike. His term he used was the undercurrent.
Yeah.
And I think that's a legitimate philosophy, that you know, we're not only having to surpass ourselves, but we have to be paying attention to the environment around us that's constantly changing. Ever since, particularly since COVID, it's like, you know, things move like a glacier. Like, you can barely see a glacier move, but every once in a while it snaps and it might surge forward, you know, 5 or 50 feet in a violent way. And I think that's what we're seeing here in the post-COVID world.
I think so. I think so too. And this beer, by the way, is opening up in a very, very pleasant way. And what I...
Oh, wow. It's,
I know.
Like, no, it's just chocolate and molasses and maple syrup.
So that bitterness is still there. But when it was, you know, 10 minutes outside of the fridge cold, it had that snap to it. You know what I mean? That bitter snap to it at the end. And it's, the bitterness is still present, but the sweetness has been dialed up just a couple notches. And with it warming it's become just so very pleasant on the palate and so very smooth going down and so very sort of everything you want a chocolate stout to be. This is absolutely fantastic.
Deb has written on the label that you should, you know, drink it at 48 degrees Fahrenheit, meaning take it out of the refrigerator and let it warm up a bit. Don't take it, you know, refrigerator is what, 38 degrees Fahrenheit.
So yeah.
let it warm up 10 degrees before you crack it and let it breathe.
And the nose on it's just absolutely amazing too. Like, yeah, it's funny. I've really enjoyed this conversation. I've been like slowly sipping this beer over this conversation. Yeah. And just every time, like you would make like a wonderful point that I want to follow up on. I was like, I need to say how much I'm enjoying this beer point. Cause I really, really am. And it's like, as we were talking and the beer was going down and warming up, I was like, it's one of those very cool occasions when it's like, I'm enjoying this more every single moment it gets a little warmer and a little further on.
Well, that's one thing that's fun about a beer is a well-made beer should develop and change as you drink it. And then it becomes a kind of a journey. Like when, if you're in a foreign country and you're riding in the train and you're looking out the window and the scenery changes, that's kind of fun. And drinking a beer, a well-made beer is the same thing, that you get all of these different outcomes or different manifestations as you work your way through the glass of beer, if you're thinking about it.
Yeah. Yeah. And a good way to drink beer, I find, is talking about beer while you're drinking beer, because you will be thinking about it as you're drinking it.
Yeah, that's right.
So, you know, sort of the final, as we're coming in on the back stretch of this, the final like sort of thing I had running through my mind is you've sort of lived this life where of course anyone who's, I guess, brewing as long as you have will kind of touch every part of it. But when you were first out of Davis, you went to work at, you know, a small startup brewery.
Yep.
And then you were at a large brewery for a while. And then you started up your own brewery. If the brewmaster you are now, and sort of seeing the 10,000 foot vision, how removed is that from like the person at Kessler's doing all of the welding and all of that stuff? And is one more comfortable, or are they both sort of just different in their own way and both unique and enjoyable in their own way? If you sort of get what I'm driving at.
It's completely different. The person I was at the age of 22 or 23 is completely different than I am here 40 years later. That when you graduate from college, when you graduate from brewing school, you are schooled in the basic science, the dogma of brewing, the accepted way, the chemistry. You know, like I could, when I graduated from school, like I could jot down, I could write the Krebs cycle on a piece of paper, you know, by chemical formulas.
Wow.
What was happening. And I certainly couldn't do that anymore. But one thing about brewing school is they don't really teach you about leadership. So being a brewmaster requires you to be a manager. And as I said, as Deb has said, people make beer, not machines. So being a leader, leadership is something that you're either born with or you're not. And if you're not born with it, you have to learn to as best you can. And so I'm now a better leader. The other thing about when you graduate from brewing school is you have somewhat of a sophomoric personality, meaning sophomoric is Greek, meaning a wise fool.
Yeah.
In other words, you think you know more than you really do know.
You know enough to get in trouble.
There's an arrogance.
Yeah.
Same thing that like young doctors have, that they know everything and they don't need to listen. And, the longer that I'm a brewer, the more I realize that I really don't know. There's a so complicated, the process of brewing is very, very deep. And it's sort of like being in a large house and you're in a room and you open a door and there are five other doors, and you open that door and there are five other doors, and you open that door. So you can do that with, say, you know, like we learned all the chemistry of hops.
Yeah.
But we didn't really learn how We didn't learn the agronomy of hops. We didn't learn how hops are processed, how they're dried, how they're stored, all of those things. And so you can pick anything, the drying temperature in an oast, in a hop kiln. What's the effect of a different temperature? You could spend the rest of your career just trying to understand that subject. So brewing is a very, very, very deep subject. And so with age comes humility, mm-hmm. and you realize how small you are and how and how much you don't know and how often the dogma of brewing is incorrect. So what might have worked for somebody else won't work for you. And so a lot of papers about brewing, there's thousands and thousands of papers, research papers. A lot of them are about making American style lager beer, you know, which rice and corn with lager yeast. Well, yeah. Most of us are making ales that are 100% malt, completely different. So what works for a lager brewer in a large brewery may not work for a craft brewer. So we have to learn our own way. And then really, I hate to say this, but a lot of people that are writing books and a lot of people, not all, but mm-hmm. Textbooks and teachers are not the ones that are doing it.
Yeah.
So the people who are actually in the trenches making the beer maybe have different opinions. Maybe they're less scientific. They're less vetted. They're less true for everybody. But I know in my world, when I do this, this is the outcome that I get.
Yeah.
And this is sort of the old European way of brewing, that brewing knowledge was handed down from father to son or daughter, generation by generation, and it was mainly kept in the plant. So it's not good for scientific blossoming.
Yeah.
It has a lot of negatives, but it means that really great beers, how do they do that? Well,
they did it their way.
Yeah, and they're not going to tell you yeah. what they're doing. So I guess what I'm trying to say is I know less than I did 40 years ago, and I've learned to be a manager, which was probably the most difficult thing in a brewery. I'm really comfortable with a calculator or a slide rule or a textbook or a calculating a table than I am with dealing with the personality conflict. So oh, I yeah. had to learn how to do that.
I'm the worst with like a personality conflict. I either do the one of two moves. It's either the now I'm going to fight like this is the most important thing that has yeah. ever mattered to me, or I'm going to sulk away saying something snide and that'll be the end of it.
Well, you know, and it used to be in the old days, I started out working in all of my jobs with mostly, and you know, my father and my uncles and the older men, my role models, mm-hmm. you know, this was the World War II generation.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, these were the guys, they don't talk about it, you know, no. suck it up.
Yeah.
So, you know, I had to do it. You do it. Shut up. Quit your whining.
Why do we do it this way? Because that's the way we do it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you don't complain.
Yeah.
You do what you got to do. Well, telling a modern worker, I had to do it. You have to do it. Suck it up and quit your whining. That don't fly.
No.
So, it's a different world. I'm not
probably
saying
a better spot for it,
well,
maybe, but
yeah, there was a lot more abuse.
Yeah.
Abuse was much more hidden
yes.
in the old days. And therefore accept it. People didn't talk about it, but nowadays it's much more open and
yeah.
you have to be more, introspective and a better listener. You know, the old days of my way or the highway, that don't work anymore.
No. And yeah.
Because people will take the highway.
They will. They, eventually they will go, well, then it's the highway. All yeah. right, fine. Well, Dan, I think we've got a firm grasp on what your day-to-day around here is like. And this has just been a really enjoyable conversation. I've really, really enjoyed this. Chocolate stout your chocolate milk stout is a great beer. It's coming around for the second time. And this is another one of your beers that you've made that's sort of pitch perfect for me, especially with being the dead of January yeah. and just dreams of spring. This is like a oasis in the middle of like the deep Wisconsin winter. So very yep. well done.
Yep. And thanks to Sam Bennett for the genesis of this combination.
And see, that's the cool thing. Collaboration brings good stuff. That's
exactly right.
Yeah. The more we collaborate, the more cool stuff we get to have.
That's right.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.